You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
Call me Mrs. What's It.
Mrs. Who?
No, Mrs. What's It. Mrs. Who is... she's like a billion years older and way more knowledgeable.
What can I do for you, Mrs. What's It?
I caught her stealing sheets. Guys, she's harmless.
You're six. Come on. What do you know about harmless?
Have I ever been wrong?
Well, one of these days you might be Charles Wallace.
Oh, I highly doubt that. He's one of the greatest minds in recent history. He's prodigious. But of course, we can't take any credit for our talents. It's how we use them that counts.
Welcome back to the 602 Club. I am your host here, Matthew Rushing, and I'm glad to be here tonight as we're going to be talking about a newer movie that just came out in the theaters called A Wrinkle in Time, and I'm very excited to have my partner in crime from our Owl Post podcast, Drea Coffin. In fact, Drea, I mean, I've got the cot in the corner. You might just want to sleep on it because you're going to be here next week, too.
I'm going to be here tomorrow anyway. And next week, yeah. I'm going to be around for a little while, guys. So sorry in advance.
Oh, no reason to be sorry. I'm really glad that you're here. And I mean, you know, kind of cool that for 2 weeks in a row, we have stories that are kind of like female-led stories, right? So it'll be interesting to see how they play out and how they do. But before we hit the movie and talk about that, I wanted to remind everybody that you can find our shows everywhere. But the best place to go to find Trek FM shows is Apple Podcasts. Find us at iTunes.com/TrekFM, and you'll find all the shows we do. Now, while you're over there, I really appreciate all the people who have already given us star ratings and reviews and hit us up with a new one. It's been a while since we've gotten one, and it definitely helps people find the show. It helps people find the show, so make sure you hit us up with a star rating review, and I'll thank you on the show when you do. Also, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. So just about every single platform you can get podcasts on, we are on, so you can find us there. We're on Twitter at TrekFM, Facebook at Facebook.com/TrekFM. You can also find us online at Trek.FM. Well, while you're over there, you can hit discussion on any of the menu bars, and that would bring you over to our listeners-only discussion group on Facebook, which is fantastic. You can find us on Facebook under the Babel Conference. You can type that into the search field, and you can also find us there. And while you're at the website, if you wanted to send us an email, go to trek.fm/contact, choose a show, choose the 602 Club, and you will be able to send me an email, and then anybody else who's on the show that week, and we can talk more about what we said, or maybe have some ideas for the show, or things you want to hear us talk about. In fact, guys, somebody hit us up on Facebook in the Babel Conference today, and they're like, hey, it'd be great if you talked about Jumanji, the new one that came out. And I was like, well, okay, so I put it on the schedule. So you never know. We had an open spot, and I was trying to figure out what to put there. And so we're going to be welcoming y'all to the jungle, man. So thank you so much for the idea. Hint, hint, it was worth talking about. So so A Wrinkle in Time came out into the movie theater. And A Wrinkle in Time is a beloved book by Madeline L'Engle. And it's been around for over 50 years now. And just a beloved childhood classic. A lot, if you've never read it, it's really in the same vein as something like The Chronicles of Narnia. It has that feel to it, and even kind of has that worldview to it. So it's very similar to that. So I wanted to ask you just kind of what your wrinkle history was. I mean, I've got a lot around my eyes these days.
I'm joining you there. We have an infant now, and yes, I'm starting to join that wrinkly club now.
Oh, well.
I remember reading it and loving it as a kid. I remember really falling in love with it. I have not read it in probably over 20 years now. I had every intention of reading it before the movie, but the aforementioned infant kind of throws a wrench into plans nowadays.
Why? So, she doesn't like to read yet?
No, she doesn't quite like to read yet. But I do remember it being a really fantastical book. I kind of went back and read up on the plot a little bit on like Wikipedia before I went to the movie just to remind myself of a few of the elements. I remembered enough about it. I remembered enjoying it enough that the trailer made me excited. I liked how fantastical it looked. I really liked how like visually stimulating it appeared to be. So I was like, hey, if it's going to be visually great and if it's the story I remember from when I was a kid, like, this is exciting. I'm all for it.
You know, it's funny because this is one that I didn't read when I was a kid, but I read it back in 2014. So it had been a while. And I enjoyed it then. You know, it's always different too when you read a children's book as an adult. You know, there's a whole, you know, different experience there. But it was interesting because before the movie came out, I do not have an aforementioned child. So, or a child in general.
So we can reread the book.
Yeah. So I had the time and I was able to reread it again. And I found myself liking the book even more the second time around, maybe because I was just picking up more nuance to it. And it's one of the things that I really like about books from that era, something like Narnia or this, or I'm even thinking a little bit earlier, like Peter Pan. A lot of times those books have a lot of hidden depth to them that a lot of children's books don't have now. It's one of the reasons I think that we both love talking about Harry Potter like we do on Outpost, because there's a lot to talk about. Rowling doesn't pull any punches with the kids. She has really deep thematic elements and ideas and the struggles of what it means to grow up and to be a person in this world. And I think La Engle does that too. You know, the main characters and everything struggle with a lot of things. They even struggle with what it means to grow up and kind of find out your parents aren't perfect and like that they can't handle everything and there are going to be things you have to learn to do on your own and stuff. Like, there's a lot of stuff going on. So I really enjoyed the reread. And so I was interested then to see the movie because, you know, I enjoyed, for the most part, the adaptation that Walden Media and Disney had done with the original Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. The other two they did were garbage, but the first one was very good.
Don't sugarcoat it at all.
Yeah, it was a good adaptation. So I was excited. I thought, okay, well, they did that right. So maybe this will turn out really well. And so, yeah, it'll be interesting to talk through the movie and see how they did. But one of the things that I thought was kind of fun was the way that they cast the movie and that they created some diversity in the characters. And one of the ways they did that, too, I thought was kind of smart is because it was never really called on. It's like it's not like made a big deal. It just is, which was great. And so what did you think of the little girl we had playing Meg? Her name's Storm Reed. How did you feel she did in the lead role? Because she has a lot to do. I mean, she's... The entire movie pretty much takes place from her point of view, really.
Right. So before I speak about her performance specifically, I want to say that this movie in general, I think it suffered from a few different things. And when I was sort of talking through my feelings for the movie as I left the theater with my husband, we really sort of had to be very cognizant and break down what didn't work for me and why that didn't work for me. So for me, I think that I was so in love with the diversity in this cast and I loved the visual component. They had a really balanced group of people. They all worked really well together. I think that some of the characters did better than others. I feel like we had some problems with Stormy and her performance as Meg, solely based on her being a child actor and solely based on the fact that she's kind of a first time starring actor and you have a first time-ish director. And I feel like the director had some learning opportunities and that she could have pulled some more out in some places. I think that part of it, the failure too, was in the writing of this character. I do not recall her being so angry in the book. And maybe that's just a recollection issue. Maybe you can help me out there. I remember her being upset that her dad left. And I remember that that was really like sort of altering to her attitude. But I don't remember that it manifesting in this like hating everyone. And I definitely remember the self-hate and the self-doubt aspects to her because I feel like that's what made her character so relatable to young girls. But I don't remember it being such like a hostile to everybody else sort of attitude. And so that to me was overshadowed the self-doubt. Like we didn't get kind of a self-doubt. We kind of got like an angry, angsty teenager, which I don't recall being the case in the book. So that didn't really like work for me.
One of the things that they do in the story is they change the fact that he's been gone only about a year or so in the book. In the movie, he's been gone 4 years.
For like 4 years.
So I think one of the things is that that hurts the story because you're kind of like, this kid would have gotten over this by this point if it had been 4 years of their life, right? I mean, like,
or they would have had been in a different place in the mourning process than she was, right? Like, she was very much so stuck at that first step of mourning and like the denial and all of that is where she still was living. And it had been so long. And there are definitely people that that is true for and that resonates for them, right? Like, there's people who it will take them 10 years to get over something like this, but it felt less believable because of how much time had passed.
Yeah. And it just didn't fit the story. And I don't know why they really changed that. It seemed to not make sense to me. And again, I do think it hurts. In the book, Meg is somebody who is kind of disgruntled and kind of treats everybody with disdain. Part of that is that the character in the book, too, is legitimately super smart. She is said to be kind of, and the whole book is about Meg and her faults, right? And the fact that her faults actually play in her impatience and all that kind of stuff. It's in fact one of the gifts that she's given by one of the misses is her faults. And it's a very important thing because it is about her uniqueness, about who she's created to be. Like that's a part of Meg learning, like everybody's created to be who they are. Not somebody else. And so this story kind of hampers because, again, I think you called out rightly, the script does not do a good enough job of explaining either of these children and their gifts. Because
any of these children and their gifts or where they came from.
Right, because, you know, the character of Charles Wallace really suffers with this as well because, again, the book goes into much more detail about how he is a very special little boy. In fact, he's not even in school at all yet. He's too young for school. So he's about probably four, almost five.
Yeah, he's not quite five, or if he's five, he's a very young five.
Right.
He's had like missed the kindergarten cutoff.
Yep. So, and that makes, again, in the book, that makes much more sense. And yet he's this intellect beyond intellects. And so, again, you get this feeling like this whole family is full of these very, very smart people. And
well, and I also think in the book, I remember they really paint out Calvin's character a lot better in the beginning. You end up with sort of this explanation of who he is. And you get a little more perspective on him and his life at the beginning. So you get kind of a character development and not just this random character who's like dropped in. And he's like, I'm just here because. Like, literally,
because
that was his reason for being there.
Because you look cute.
And then there's this... Oh, yeah, I don't even get me started on that yet. But it's just like there isn't a good character development. You don't quite care about them yet, but you kind of do. But you definitely... like. By the way, I would see the actor who plays Charles Wallace in anything else that he's ever in, because in this dark drab, he was him and Reese Witherspoon were the two standout characters for me. I would go see them again in a heartbeat. But there was just so much that didn't make sense about her character and didn't feel like it was believable, and it didn't feel like it was really pulled out of her the way maybe a more seasoned director could have done. Okay, so let's play around with this. Okay, that's good. You're saying the right things, but we're not really seeing them in the body language. So let's try this again. Let's make it a little more over the top, because then it'll come across as real. You know, I felt like there was a lot of her looking into the camera very intensely. Like, I really wish you guys could all could visually see, because she was like very much so like like lots of staring directly into the camera through her glasses. Like, she acted the crap through her glasses, which is really hard for actors to do, is to act through their props. But she really acted through those glasses, like she was not letting them impede her in any way. But it just wasn't believable. It wasn't enough for me. I think she has potential, but I don't know that it was pulled out in her in this particular movie.
Yeah, and I agree, because honestly, I feel like the main issue here is that the setup for the story and for the children and the characters, their characterization and understanding who they are and why they are the way they are and all of that, it doesn't come across strongly enough, so that in the important moments, like when you get to the end and everything, we don't really understand why Charles Wallace is the only one to go off with the it.
And you kind of don't care.
Yeah. Because
like you want him to be okay, but like you kind of don't care.
Yeah, you don't. And then it's unfortunate too, because the main reasons that Calvin is there in the book, because he's somebody who can talk to people and that kind of stuff, never gets played out in this story whatsoever. So he just kind of becomes this strange love interest for Meg, which is very, I wouldn't say it's
weird,
minor
and inappropriate.
I wouldn't say it's minor to the book, but it's also not the only reason he's there. But this feels like the only reason he's there is because he kind of likes her.
So there's this trope that women get often in books and movies and things, and that they are, the female character is often there to further the development and the plot for whatever male main character. It's just, you know, I think Bond, the Bond girls, they really serve no purpose other than to further the character of James Bond, right? It almost felt like a turn play on that, and that Calvin's character was only there to further Meg's character, which doesn't make him a valued character.
Right.
Like, you don't care about him. You aren't really vested in him. And because they're such young kids, you're also not really vested in their relationship either, because it's weird and creepy and kind of gross.
Yeah, you're like, they're 14, so okay.
And you don't even know how old they are. Yeah. They could be 12 for all you know. Like, they're very young. Like, that, you don't know how old they are. You're never given any context into like what grade they're in or anything like that. So, and they both look very young for their age. So in the book, I want to say you're right, they're like 14, but in the movie, they look like they could be 12.
Yeah.
Like, they look like they could be at the start of middle school. And just, there's just these weird moments between them where they're building this sexual chemistry and they're like really close together, and there's like these close-ups of them like staring at each other. And they picked a kid, a male kid with like super sensual lips that he always sort of purses out. And you're like, okay, can we stop?
Yeah.
And then even at the end, they hug and you're like, this is still just kind of creepy. And And then the dad's watching. I don't know. It just, I think I'm summing it up well there.
Yeah. Title of the show. Ew.
He was not there as his character. He had one moment of peril where you were kind of like, well, that sucks. He fell off the back of that. But even then, you just, you don't ever really know that he gets saved by Tessering. Like, he just, if you're not going to invest fully in that character, you should have just omitted the character altogether. It was not needed.
Right, right. Well, and again, in many ways, they
did
excise the part of the book that has to do with his character and the reason that he's there. And so, and because of that, he becomes a superfluous character that you've kind of only put in because he's one of the quote unquote main characters from the story, but you haven't made him one. So,
right. They omitted lots of other characters. I mean,
they had two other kids that they totally
Yeah, the made. Murray family was much bigger than it was twins. In the movie. Yeah. And she was the oldest and the twins were in the middle and then there was Charles Wallace and yeah, it was real weird. The editing choices and the adaptation choices they made were not.
Yeah, good. Absolutely. Yeah, no, we'll talk about that a little bit later because I have some actual camera work and stuff. Complaints.
Some thoughts.
Yeah. But thoughts. What about the misses? We have Miss Witch, Miss What's It, and Miss Who. What did you think? Because we've got Oprah, Reese Witherspoon, and Mindy Kaling.
Okay, so very different from the book. Again, there are these very elaborate dress costumes and it's visually beautiful and stimulating. I don't mind that deviation from the book. I loved Reese Witherspoon as Miss What's It. She rocked it to me, like the perky, spunky, has this like forgets that they're human. Like I thought that was great, and it reminded me a lot of the original story. Like I was so on board for that. Mindy Kaling was just Mindy Kaling. She was just
quoting all the wrong people.
Yeah, I mean, I get what she was trying to. They were trying to modernize the same thing.
Yeah, but at least find quotes that have something similar to what they were in the book.
Or at least try to make them as bigger than life as sort of Reese Witherspoon was playing, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, you're quoting larger like than life outcast. Character. Come on.
I mean, just make them more over the top.
Yes.
That character needed to be a little. She was supposed to be the quirky one, and she was not quite quirky enough for me. Mindy Kaling, it was like watching her just be Kelly Kapoor, but in like a weird dress. And then she stopped. Then sometimes she would quote and sometimes she wouldn't quote. And they explained it once, but then they never explained it again when she did it again. And it didn't work for me. And lastly, Miss Who?
Oprah.
Yeah, Oprah.
No, she's and Miss lastly, Witch. Mindy Kaling's Miss Who.
Yes. Okay, Miss Witch, Oprah. To me, it was just watching Oprah. It was watching Oprah be Oprah. I would have, again, liked a little larger than life, a little over the top. I feel like all three of those characters are so quirky and over the top and so different that the moment she has with Meg when they're walking in to see the seer, I could have been so much greater if she was such an over the top person and then she kind of had like a down to earth, let's talk about this for real moment. But instead she sort of had this just, I'm Oprah and I'm playing Oprah as Oprah. And again, to me, that goes back to the director being a newer director, not being able to out that Oprah-ness, right? Not being able to push her further and push her bigger. It's either that she was intimidated because it's a freaking Oprah, right? And she's a huge name. Or she just didn't feel like it needed to. But I didn't buy it. I was watching Oprah. She wasn't able to break the stereotype of her off-screen persona using her character. And it just didn't.
Yeah. Honestly, I think this is why you don't cast somebody like Oprah for this role.
Agreed.
Mainly because also the role just had her coming off as pontificating the gospel according to Oprah. And that's not what this story needs, because that's not right. Who the story is whatsoever in the book, and it's not what this is about. But in the end, the thematic elements became so much closer to the things that Oprah is famous for talking about in her kind of worldview than what the actual worldview of the book was. And that exorcism of thematic elements destroyed the story, actually. And it right. really hurt that it was Oprah there to do it because, again, like you're saying, she's just overpowering everything with her Oprah-ness.
Right.
And, you know.
I get why Disney wanted to remove the religious elements of the story. I get why they wanted to do that because you're trying to appeal to a larger audience because you're trying not to be affiliated with any sort of religious thematics, right? Like, especially considering sort of the legacy that your founder has with his anti-Semitics. Like, I get that you're trying to sort of not align in a religious fashion. And there's a couple things to that. One, don't make a religious movie.
Yeah.
Don't make A Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah.
Right. Call it something else, right? Some story inspired by A Wrinkle in Time or something. Like, I don't know. Call it something else. Or you still have to remove those elements and then make sure your story still makes sense without those pieces. Mm-hmm. And by doing that and then replacing those pieces with a well-known character who sort of has her own life philosophy and her own sort of dogma, if you will, you've not religiously affiliated yourself, but you've still sort of added a focus. You've added, like you were saying, a gospel of sorts to it that's just not religiously based. And it just didn't, It's not the same. It didn't work quite the same, Especially considering that not everyone knows what Oprah's like. Not everyone watched Oprah every day. Not everyone knows what her philosophies are and how it works and knows what to expect and can fill in those blanks like you can with a mainstream religion like Christianity or Judaism or something like that, Where a lot of those things are already known and they're sort of like, you can sort of expect your viewers to know when you say God what that sort of means, or when when you say good and evil, you can have some idea what the context is there. When you take that out, you have to now reintroduce what those are, and they didn't do that at all. They just sort of assumed you knew.
Yeah, I mean, you nailed it on the head. They took out the foundation of the story, which was the Christian theological basis of La Ingalls' characterization and thematic elements for the story. They excised those and they tried to replace them with something else, but that something else doesn't have the weight to hold the foundation of the story, and it just kind of comes crumbling down because none of the things make sense. Specifically, this evil it and all of that, it just doesn't make sense without the foundation of Christianity. And like you said too, you can tell a story with the themes that they have in this movie, but you can't call it A Wrinkle in Time. It's a disservice to a 50-year-old book that's beloved by millions of people around the world. And it's a disservice to anybody who sees the movie. It's a disservice to the adaptation and the characters that you get. And it's like that.
You set an expectation by using that as your basis, and we go in expecting something along those lines. And when you take such a large thematic element, whether you like it or not, out, and you don't replace it with anything, and two, you just completely change it. Like, it's no longer true to what we're expecting, and that's not, you're setting your viewers up for an experience that you're not delivering.
Yep.
Which is exactly what happened.
Yes. Well, and they should expect, I mean, it'd be like going to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and excising the lion.
Yeah, or we were talking about like watching Harry Potter, but they're not wizards.
Right.
Like reading Harry Potter, but they're not wizards.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. And so, yeah, for me, Oprah doesn't work at all. I'm right there with you, too. I didn't feel like Mindy Kaling had much to do, and I don't feel like that they made her special enough. One of the interesting quirky things about her in the book is, that she's always just quoting things because for her it's difficult to think in our language anyway. And so it's easier for her to just quote people. And the quotes don't have as much weight here because she's quoting ridiculous things
outcast. And some of the quotes just also don't really make sense. Like, there are stronger quotes you could have pulled to say the same thing. And they picked like these weaker quotes that don't quite have the same definition and like depth to them.
Right.
They're all very superficial.
And, I think the one person that I did enjoy was Miss What's-It. I think you're right. Reese Witherspoon kind of really had, I think she was just having a great time with it and having a, and I also, the other thing that I think is, I actually think that the costuming design for them limited all of them so much. Like, Mindy Kaling could barely walk in her costumes. So, why do they look like bejeweled fairies? Like, that's not how they're described in the book at all. And to me, it seemed like amateur hour at a really bad high school play, that they literally have bejeweled eyebrows. Like,
I visually loved it. I thought they were beautiful and stimulating, and it made them kind of stand apart from what, like, you think of regular humans, because they're not supposed to be human, right? So I liked that they went real bold, but I agree in that it was very actually physically restricting for the actors. You know, you gave kind of a flowy dress for Reese Witherspoon so she could move around in her arms and her legs and kind of run, even though in the weird sheet one at the beginning, which was kind of weird with the cloud sheet thing over her head. But I do agree that some of that was too restricting, or even if it wasn't physically restricting on them, the actors were acting like it was. So even if she could still move around a lot, she didn't. So it looked like it was because of this weird dress with these giant, like, saddles for hips, you know? Like, I think you could have found a compromise in there and made it magical and beautiful without it being so restrictive. Like, you could have made it, whenever I think of, like, the magical, weird costumes, I think of Stardust, where they have some color and some vibrancy, but they're still moving and flowing, and their bodies are still a part of the acting. It wasn't the case in this.
Well, and the other thing, too, and this is something, you know, the book, the misses are characters that feel a lot more like the witch at the beginning of Beauty and the Beast, who comes to the home, isn't beautiful, is very unassuming, and of course the prince dismisses, right? Everybody kind of would dismiss the misses here, and yet they've made them these unmissable people, and yet that's not who they are portrayed in the book. And so again, I feel like the costuming takes them so over the top, it's hard to buy that people wouldn't just be like, what the heck is walking down the street? It doesn't make a lot of sense. So
it's just is one more thing that just they tried so hard to make this visually stimulating and beautiful environment, and I think they succeeded, but there was no context behind it. And in the book, they spend a lot of times in a lot of different worlds. And because of time, they spend a lot of time in one place and some time in another. And that was it. Like, it, he was the only other time you got to see any of these other three or four universes that the dad tethered to was in Meg's vision. So you got a less than a second snippet of some of these fantastical worlds that we really get to explore more in the book. And so they invested a lot of time and a lot of money right in the beginning. And then that was it. We went to one fantastical place, and that was about all we went.
What did you think about the happy medium and changing that from being a woman to Zach Galifianakis and then giving him a flirtation with Miss What's-It?
I thought it was cute. I didn't really care about the flirtation. It is what it is. I thought the idea of this weird... I like when she's like, oh, I'm, you know, when you're a billion years old, like... You know, labels are, you know, they don't define you or whatever. You don't need a defined relationship or whatever. I thought that was really cute. And I thought Zach Galifianakis did a great job. I had very low expectations for him. But again, I think that the people who did the best in this movie are the people who are used to playing a character that's over the top. Because I think that's really what this needed, is a lot of over the top. And I think unless you were going to let Mindy Kaling be Mindy Kaling and be this super drama-y, over-the-top girl, which could have been hilarious as Mrs. Who, you could have totally let her do that. Unless you sort of had those over-the-top attitudes, I don't know that the characters worked. Which is why, like, Reese Witherspoon's over-the-top character worked. She's sassy, right? She's done that before. She's been in sassy movies since the 90s. Zach Galifianakis being just sort of weird and out there. He's done that before. Like, and they both did great at it. So I liked him as the seer. I liked he was able to evoke some emotion. I think that was probably the only time in the movie, the scene with him and Meg and their sort of like connection. I think that was the only time that I was actually sort of invested in this movie and like really sort of drawn in and was like, oh, okay, there's potential. And then we leave him and we don't have anything else. And I was like, no, come back. I never thought I'd say that about Zach Galifianakis, but come back.
I think part of it was I was struggling with why they needed him to be a him, because in the book it's another her.
It's another her.
And it seemed kind of strange to me that you would do a sex change on this character. And then the flirtation part, I mean, it's fine, but it also just distracts, I think, from what's really supposed to be happening in the story there, because this it's supposed to be focused on Meg at that point and them finding her father and all this stuff. And I feel like, again, this is the script just having a problem of trying to kind of insert more modern type things into the story because they think that's what it needs, but it doesn't need this. It's not awful.
I can see that.
It's not bad. It just doesn't need it. And it kind of is distracting from what really is important. Like you said, the moment where Meg is kind of struggling to kind of find her balance, find her medium. And, you know, they have the moment. And I think that is nice. But it has less weight to it because they kind of spent so much time at the beginning of this of these scenes, like him flirting with, you know, Reese Witherspoon's Miss Wetsit. And them kind of going back and forth, and that's not the focus of this scene, but you know we spend at least a good 2 minutes having some back and forth with them and all this stuff.
I guess I didn't find that part as distracting as the good solid 2 to 3 minutes we spent on everyone trying to get their balance.
Yes.
Like
yes.
Nothing in this movie was paced appropriately.
No.
It didn't have a good pacing. They didn't know when to shorten things and lengthen others. And I mean, watching them all stumble on these weighted blocks, you could have done that in like 15 seconds. You could have done that 15, 20 seconds would have had the same impact, but instead we had to spend a good solid 2 to 3 minutes watching them all struggle and then them try to get their balance. And then it was like not, it wasn't over the top enough to be comical, but it was too long to be an aside. And The pacing was just off. I guess for me, the flirting... Well, first of all, I didn't even remember that the seer was supposed to be a woman. So for me, I didn't even know that. Like, that didn't even occur to me. Probably the joys of not having read the book. Again, more recently. But for me, I think just he did such a great job that I was just happy for a breath of fresh air. Like, I was just happy that that was... Mm-hmm. He was good at that role and that we had a good scene there. And it was one of those things where I feel like at that point I'd pretty much just written off the movie. And I was like, well, I'm going to find the enjoyable parts of this that I can and enjoy them because there's going to be lots that I don't enjoy. And there's so much of it that I'm not a fan of. So I think for me, I was just kind of happy to have something that was enjoyable. Mm-hmm. And I was expecting it to be terrible. I went in going, this is going to be bad. And then it was good. And I was like, oh, okay. I'm pleasantly surprised. So I guess I was like, you know what? If it worked and it made me smile. That's where we're going to go with and we're going to move on. So I think at that point, I lowered my expectations so much. I was just like, I don't care. If it's enjoyable, it's enjoyable. None of this is true to the book. I've let that go.
Yeah. The one thing that, too, they missed about the medium scene was that it explains the why of all this.
Yeah.
You know, they explain what this black thing is. It's the personification of evil, and the medium helps them see how Earth is partially covered in the darkness, but it's the great, you know, religious figures like, you know, Gandhi and Buddha and, you know, Jesus and the philosophers and the artists who have been fighting against this. And in fact, they even reveal that Miss What's-It was actually a former star who exploded in self-sacrifice to fight the darkness. So, they kind of took away a lot of special and things that help you understand the why of the story because they're too busy playing around with silly things, like you said, trying to, like, balance. And it doesn't make sense. And I think the worst in the adaptation there was when they went to Camazotz. And that story, they do this whole action scene where they have to get over this wall or whatever that is absolutely 100%. Not only is it not in the book, but it's just an absolute waste of time. It's like they felt like they just needed an action scene to be an action scene. But again, you took away from all the storytelling elements of the why when you get there and all the stuff that happens and the fact that, you know, this is a place where it has taken over and everybody is in lockstep with the it. Like, you don't have a choice. You're, it's the happy bliss of not having to choose, right? Because the it makes the choice for you. Like, you lose all sense of anything that you are because you're only the it, and you don't have a choice but to be the it because you've chosen to let the it control your life. You know, and again, it's a
religious thing.
You're so worked up. Yeah, I'm so worked up because it's a, I wish you all could see him. He's so angry.
It's a religious, it's the religious aspect of the story of, and she's using it as the parallel for sin, that you're stuck. You can't choose. And it's only the people who fight against that and like choose to be who God made them to be, that, you know, they're God-given talents to be the unique person that God created them to be, that can fight against it, which is, again, it's the religious figures and the philosophers and the artists and all these people who embrace fully who they're meant to be and use their talents to then spread that to others. But they don't do any of that. And it just, and then it doesn't make any sense because, like, then Charles Wallace turns and they haven't explained that. So the adaptation in the script fully fall apart here because, again, they're not willing to have the foundation of the story. And then they won't fill the foundation with anything that can actually hold what they're trying to do. So.
And it felt so... At my job, my like everyday, my non-602 club movie watching job, I do some of the things I do is like I train people on stuff. So either new topics or, you know, career development skills, like lots of stuff, right? You train things. And I in turn attend a lot of trainings on stuff, right? And there's this thing that trainers do when they're unprepared and that they'll be talking about a topic. Oh, and then you do this. Oh, and this is an aside. Oh, and you need to know this. They'll just throw it in. I feel like this movie did that.
Oh, and.
A lot. Oh, and by the way, you're really smart and we're going to give you an opportunity to show that you know how physics works in your mind. Except for you really don't know how physics works because that wasn't actually physics. And, you know, like he's just going to look at you with this weird, like, you're so smart. Like, it's just weird. They kept throwing these things in there because they forgot. They realized they hadn't told you it yet. Oh, yeah, that's right. We haven't painted the fact that Meg's really smart. Oh, yeah, we haven't painted the fact that Charles Wallace is this child prodigy who's super susceptible to the it. Oh, yeah, we haven't painted the fact that Calvin is the diplomat. So we're going to just throw that in here. Just going to throw it in this salad. They're just like, oh, yeah, and, oh, and, oh, we haven't established the fact that they needed to build trust together. So we're going to create this giant elaborate scene that forces Calvin to trust Meg. Oh, yeah, and like that's exactly what the end of this movie was. It was like, oh, yeah, we never told them this. We never told them this. And they're just like throwing it. It's like darts at a dartboard. They're just throwing it at it, hoping something sticks. And they never, it's like they created the story and went on and never went back to the beginning and said, let's read this all the way through and see if it makes sense, because it really doesn't make sense. You should have introduced these things earlier. When you're at the final climax, you should not be introducing new information. You shouldn't be having Meg use physics for the first time 90 minutes into the 2-hour-long movie. You know, you shouldn't have trust being established 90 minutes into the movie when you should have had been doing that all along. And, you know, it's just there were things that they just we should have told you that the what's it can't go to, you know, Camazod. That the who's can't go to, or the W's misses can't go to Camazod because, you know, there's no light there. Like, they mention that, but only after they go there. You know, like, it just, nothing worked. Nothing was presented at the right time. We spent a lot of time in that field, like a way long amount of time in that field. Way longer than we needed to spend. And it just, it was hard. It was really, really hard.
Well, and a couple of things, too, is that one of the nice thematic elements that plays out is that when Kate's dad, Dr. Burry, and Calvin and her escape from Camazot.
They try, and they end up
in the book on this other planet called Excel.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that's not in the story at all. But it's at that point where we have this glorious character. They're in this place that's like nobody can see, but these characters can see that live there. And we meet Aunt Beast, who's a great character. And
Meg has to overcome the anger she has at her father for not being able to fix everything. And it's this wonderful coming-of-age moment where you realize that your parents can't solve all your problems. And that there are going to be times where you are going to be required to solve your own problems. And that it's going to be her that has to save the day because she has this love for Charles Wallace that her dad doesn't have that same connection because he's been gone. And it's this whole beautiful thing. And that's totally lost in the movie. And it's sad because it's a much better moment than Chris Pine's character getting the whole, well, I wanted to shake hands with the universe and maybe it was kind of selfish for wanting to leave and everything. Like, it's, I get what they're trying to do, but it's not a good enough, it's not a good enough foundation as it was as L'Engle wrote it in the book. And again, what they were placing it with just isn't working thematically on screen. And I think you adequately put everything that it just became and they kept doing that. But then they ran out of and you were just left with just this kind of muddled thing at the end that wasn't making a ton of sense. And part of it, the biggest part, is that when you pull the core out of a story and you try and tell the story still, if you've taken away its heart, you have to replace it.
You have to put something else there. You had to figure out if you were going to remove religion and Christianity from the story, you had to find something to fill that void. I don't know if it's possible. I'm sure it is. It may not be. I don't know. But they didn't replace it with anything. Yeah. They tried to replace it with love, but not strongly enough. And it didn't work. For me, her dad really let me down. And it was very different from the book, because in the book, she learns her parents aren't, or her dad in particular, is not capable of something, right?
He's not a perfect person, too. Like, those are the,
Right. Right. And then in the movie, though, it was different. It was that he chose not to do something, which made him not a perfect person, which is a very, very different parental feeling. You have this more like, now Meg has to live with this guilt of knowing her dad would have left her brother behind, versus in the book where it was he wasn't capable of it. It's not that in the movie, it's not that he couldn't have done it. He could have let Meg try. Like, they could have tried, but he just was so afraid he didn't do it. It was a different flaw, and it was a much bigger flaw. And it really, it's one of those flaws that as a parent, it forces your kid to grow up a lot faster. Like, Meg had to grow up, and it's a lot to cope with. It's a lot different than learning your parents are not as capable of everything. It was a very different parental flaw. And it was hard. It was hard to watch. And it was hard for them to watch their reunion when he came back in and had to apologize. Like, you left your son, and not because you couldn't get to him, but because you were too afraid. And that is different than in the book, where he was not capable of it. And she was, it didn't make her special. It made her like the only one willing to, which is different, and very different fault.
Exactly.
And not the point. And it was, it was hard to watch. It was really hard to watch.
Well, and again, there's this whole thing too about love in the story. And like you said, can you excise the heart of a story, especially something as big as, you know, basically taking Christianity out of something, and can you find something to replace it with? And they obviously did not find the right thing to try and replace it with. And I think you asked a great question. Can you do it? Well, at least from this movie, you can't. Like, this movie, the answer is no. You cannot replace Christianity with something else, because the philosophies that they try to replace it with just don't hold up thematically to the story that they should be trying to tell. And I think that the problem with it is that everything ends up wishy-washy, and it doesn't make a lot of sense in the end, because the love and the idea of evil and all of these things clearly have a firm foundation as you're reading L'Engle's story. And even if you don't believe in the same thing, you understand where she's coming from, and it makes thematic sense. Here, by the time we get to the end of the movie, it doesn't make a lot of thematic sense. And in the end, too, I feel like the movie's
greatest thing to say is that really what's best for the universe is that you learn to love yourself.
Yeah.
That's...
And the movie paints this dad as someone who wants to touch the stars and do these things, and it's amazing. And the mom is really this character that helps him love humanity and brings it back, right? Which is kind of an interesting story we could get into in terms of scientists and the lack of emotional intelligence and all that stuff. That could be its own whole webcast if you really want it to be. But it made it feel like the Tesseract was almost not a choice. It was almost like he stumbled upon it, right? And he wanted to learn this, and all of a sudden it happens, and he's like, oh my gosh, what happened? And then when you meet him, he apologizes like he did it intentionally. Like, oh, I didn't mean to leave you guys forever, but I meant to do this on purpose, which doesn't really add up with what you'd seen so far. And it doesn't, it almost makes you dislike his character even more. Like, I disliked that dad by the time we got done with this movie, that I was like, that dad should have stayed gone. That dad should have been a sacrifice. He should have died. He should have died trying to save Charles Wallace. Like, there was so much I didn't want him to come back because he wasn't good. He wasn't good for them. He wasn't teaching them good morals. He wasn't being a strong dad for them. Like, he loved Meg, but you've also got him loving one kid over another because it's his biological kid instead of his adopted kid. So now you've hit this weird line.
They didn't explain very well, because in the book, it's very clear that Meg has the relationship with Charles Wallace because she's been around Charles Wallace since he's been cognizant, right? They don't do that well enough. And by making him adopted, I get what they're trying to do, but I think they actually hurt the story more than help it because of what ends up happening. The other thing is, too, is that, yeah, right, the tessering thing, you know, the idea that love is the frequency of the universe. Like, that's great. That's kind of cool. That's, you know, that's very interstellar of them, which I love Interstellar, and I love the idea of this idea of love being something that we can't explain, right?
Agreed. I like the concept. Yes. I really like that.
But here again, they just don't do it well enough to where it makes you feel like it makes sense. And I think, you know, we could continue to go on, but I'd say lastly, in adaptation or, you know, production design, the thing that kind of really bothered me was the way that they move the camera is awful in the movie, where everything seems to be close up on their face.
Yeah.
And I don't know. There's nothing about the way the camera moves in this movie that I like. And I also did not like that it felt like a weird Grey's Anatomy episode that they threw in these random pop songs.
The score, yeah.
Yeah, it just didn't fit. It doesn't fit the movie. Like, there's so much about what they're trying to do.
My husband had a theory on the score, because I agree. I feel like music is something that can have a dramatic impact on the movie.
Oh, absolutely.
Think about Jurassic Park and Harry Potter. Those theme songs are so iconic that you don't even have to have seen the movie, but you hear it, you know, and it gives you a feeling and a thought. Right. It's so powerful. And my husband has this theory, and I totally agree, that they spent tons and tons of money in these visual effects, right? Because they're stimulating. There's lots of color. It's very strong in the CGI. Like, everything is over the top, right? And then they got down to the end, and they're like, oh, crap, we're out of money. And what do we do for a score? Because we have no money. And since it's Disney, they went, oh, we have this whole vault of music. We'll just use whatever's in the Disney vault. We'll find something that fits. It's almost like they went to a closet and said, oh, it's okay. We'll just make this work. And because they did that, it didn't work. Because they weren't thoughtful in what they selected, and they didn't invest in that as much as they invested in this, like, visual effects. So you have these stunning, beautiful visual effects and zero score to go with them. Like, the scene with the flowers that are talking in color, you needed a strong, beautiful music to go with that, that was upbeat and you could hear in an orchestra playing at a symphony. And I don't even remember what it was. It was so forgettable. So I agree. I think that they pulled from, like, a backlog of scores that are either free or really cheap for Disney to use because they already own them. And it just was whatever was left over. They did.
Yeah, it wasn't good. It just doesn't work. You know, I get, you know, Disney loves, you know, Demi Lovato and stuff, but it
it doesn't fit with the flow of the movie. And so I guess I want to ask you, if you were to rate A Wrinkle in Time, what would you rate A Wrinkle in Time, Drea?
Would give it 1 out of 3 misses.
Okay. Yeah.
Or that's like 3.5
yeah.
out of 10. I liked that it had good intentions. Maybe you hadn't called it A Wrinkle in Time, I'd feel differently. Mm.
You know what they say about the road to hell?
It's paved with good intentions, y'all.
Yeah.
And A Wrinkle in Time, apparently.
My wife will tell you, and our friends that I went to the movie with will tell you that I turned to them when this was over, and I was livid. Absolutely livid at what I'd seen. And I was so angry that you would take A Wrinkle in Time, a, you know, beloved children's classic, and turn it into this. Again, like you said, I think you called it out perfectly. Just tell this somewhere else and call it something different. But don't call it A Wrinkle in Time. And so, for me, this is 1.5 out of 10 Miss What's-It dress changes. It is that bad. And it gets an extra 0.5 star, maybe just because I enjoy Reese Witherspoon.
Mm-hmm.
But
and that kid who plays Charles Wallace.
He was pretty cute.
For having zero direction and not like a good, well-developed character, he did a great job of being this odd child prodigy who becomes this sort of evil mastermind and then loves his sister.
Yeah, he played like kind phenomenal. Of obnoxious, know-it-all, I don't know how to deal with the fact that I know more than everybody kind
of
thing.
Loves his sister endlessly. Like, I totally bought the love from Charles Wallace to Meg. Like, that direction, I think he did a phenomenal job. Like, he did awesome. I want to see what he does next because he's great.
Yeah.
Maybe that's where my stars come from, is him and Reese Witherspoon. I would totally go, I would watch a movie with the two of them any day.
Yeah.
Put it on Lifetime. I don't know.
It was frustrating. And one of the things that was an interesting thing for Drea and I to have to do here, I think, is we tried to be as constructive as possible with every thing that we said that we had a criticism of, and to say why it doesn't work for us and what you should try to do to fix it. But I do feel like that this movie is kind of unfixable unless you just want to go with what was on the page thematically. Otherwise, I just don't think you should have told the story. So, but very excited.
I want to believe. Yeah, for me, I want to believe there was something you could have done. If you wanted to remove religion, I feel like with a stronger script, you could have woven that love theme in a little bit stronger. It might have been different than the book, and maybe that's where we should have called it something else, or it's a story inspired by The Wrinkle in Time. We have lots of movies like that. I want to believe they could have done better at this, but I just feel like it was so many first-time or not well-guided decision makers along the way that I think we just had one impediment after another. And I think all of that together, just the second we started the movie and he's talking to her and we start the next scene of her waking up during the storm repeating the exact words we had just heard, I was like, uh-oh, we're in for it. Like, yikes. So I want to believe it could have been great. I feel like give it 10 years and someone will remake it again and maybe they'll do a better job. I don't know. But I had faith it could have been done and they just didn't do it. They didn't even come close. So,
well, and yikes. And I would say, you know, again, you know, you had the wherewithal to do Narnia and to do it right, for the most part. There's nothing wrong with telling this story, and just sticking by it, you know, It's the story itself, if you've read the book, is a little bit open-minded, because when she's calling out religious figures, she doesn't just call out Jesus, right? So,
well, and she got on a real life page. So the author used to also write for one of the evangelical groups, like for their newsletters mm-hmm. and their content and stuff. And she got a lot of flack and a lot of pushback for this book because it's not sort of a mainstream Christian view. And it's not this like exact defined destiny that the church always had supported. So it was a religious book for sure, because, you know, she's a religious author, but mm-hmm. it was definitely more of a new age approach to it, especially when you're talking, it was the 60s. It was definitely a new way of thinking about it. So, you know, you could have played with that a little bit. You could have still talked about the themes mm-hmm. without calling them God or directly calling them out. So there was things you could have done, but Disney just failed on this one, and that does not happen often. Disney does not often complete failures. Yeah. So I'm curious. I'm a little hesitant, only because Disney doesn't fail often, right? We kind of just covered that, but you have such a diverse cast, and you have a female of color director, and I'm a female of color lead. And, you know, I worry that no one will take a chance again. And I don't want to see that, because I still think they have so much to offer. And I don't think that it was any one person's fault, right? This didn't happen because one person ruined everything. So I feel like I'm nervous whether we're still going to see this sort of diversity going forward, or if a large studio like Disney is just going to be like, well, we tried that once in A Wrinkle in Time and it didn't work. So I really, really don't want that to be the case. And I really want to see these actors do more, and I want to see this director do more, and I want to see what happens. And maybe we can just not, maybe Oprah could go back to doing voice work, because she did great at that. But maybe we just need less Oprah face on the screen, especially being 20 feet tall or whatever. I don't know. But I want to see more. I just don't want to see that again.
Yeah, look, I don't think any of that was the problem. Ava,
no, I agree.
Directed Selma, and Selma's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't think any of those things were an issue. Any of the choices they made for the cast and what, you know, color they were, that is absolutely has nothing to do with this. It has to do with the script and the choices made with the production. And so, and part of that is the director, but maybe she was mishired for this job. And that's totally, and again, that happens to directors, right? You know, I mean, not everything that Steven Spielberg's directed has been a hit. So, and been the best movie ever. So it's just part of it. So no, this has nothing to do with a person's ethnicity or anything like that. It just has to do with the job that they did in the movie that they made. And sometimes you have a hit and sometimes you don't. This one just doesn't work.
I am more saying I don't want the studio to use this as a crutch. Like, I don't want them to use this as to place that blame. I don't want to see other movies or studios use this as an excuse for that, because you're right. It's not any of this fault it's a combination of fault. Oh, yeah. It's between script and maybe the director not being supported by producers or the studio. I don't know. We don't know, but it's definitely a script flaw. There's definitely some post-production flaws here. But I mean, I really hope this doesn't cause future studios not to take a risk mm-hmm. or not to look past some of these attributes that have held these people back for so long.
Think about this. Black Panther is making $1 billion, right? And it's directed by Ryan Coogler, and you know, he did a fantastic job in his direction.
And Jordan Peele just won several awards for Get Out, you know, which was a horror movie which is amazing.
So I mean, again, I think that we can't be in that place for sure. We do need to be able to say, as I think we adequately did on the episode here, that there are a lot of bad decisions in this movie. Part of that's the director. Part of that's the writers or the script. Part of that's the studio. Part of that maybe that the choice in an actor that they did get for the roles. I mean, there's blame to go around for everyone. This movie just doesn't work. It's a train wreck, and it's disappointing that that's the case, because it's a well beloved book, and with Disney you would hope that they would do it right, and they just don't hit the mark in this one. And that's okay. It's gonna happen. It's not the end of the world. It is just a movie.
It's bound to happen at some point, yeah. Disney.
So, but I'm really glad we got a chance to talk to this, because I think it's, look, I think us having this conversation, we're trying to articulate adequately and without trying to tear anybody down why this doesn't work, and just say, hey, it doesn't work. That's okay. And I think that it's a good conversation to be able to have in this world where everything is either the best or the worst. This is closer to the worst, but I think we can talk about why that's the case, the decisions you make, and be constructive in that, so that our feedback isn't, well, that was just stupid and that was just dumb, and like that's not good conversation. So if you saw the movie and you love it, let us know why. Hit us up on all of the social media platforms. Like us there, follow us, and comment back. We'd love to hear what you have to say. I want to thank Ken Tripp and Davis Grayson for supporting us over on Patreon. They're our associate producers here on the 602 Club, and really appreciate them. Now, Patreon is the way that you can support the network and make sure that all the shows that we do keep coming to you each and every week, because there is no way that we can, as hosts, pay for everything that this network has. It's just too big, so we need your help. Go over to patreon.com/trekfm and see how you can become part of our team. We have many different ways we love giving back to you. Again, it's patreon.com/trekfm. Now, Drea, if anybody wants to catch up with you, talk to you, see what's going on, what else you're up to, where can people find you?
You can come listen to more of Matt and I dribble about fun stuff, and come listen to us on the Nerd Party. We do a podcast called The Owl Post, where we're going through and doing Harry Potter chapter by chapter. We are through books 1, 2, and 3 and just a few chapters into The Goblet of Fire. So you can come listen to us talk more there if you had a good time today, which I hope you did. Or you can find me on social media. I'm on Twitter at PCFChick, or I'm on Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and it's COFFMAN.
And you could find me on Twitter at MattRushing02, I'm on Instagram under the same name. I'm here in the network, of course, doing The Orb, Chris Jones, talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. I'm also over on the Nerd Party Network, but I'm not with Drea, I'm with my friend John, talking all about Star Wars on Aggressive Negotiations. It is a blast. I hope you will check it out. In fact, we were just celebrating the end of Rebels with co-executive producer Henry Gilroy. So check out that interview. It was a blast. If you love Rebels, want to know more about it, the entire series, check that episode out. And you can also find me doing a show called Cinema Stories with my friend Courtney, where we talk all about films through the lens of faith. And you may just hear us talk about soon A Wrinkle in Time. So thank you so much for joining us. And y'all come back now.